Gildan Media, a division of Recorded Books, presents Plato and the Nerd, The Creative Partnership of Humans and Technology by Edward Ashford Lee. Narrated by Timothy Andres Pabon. Publisher's note: this audiobook is packaged with bonus material, which has been included on the first audio CD. If you downloaded this book, please contact whomever you purchased this audiobook from to request the material. Preface: what this book is about. When I was young, my father wanted me to become a lawyer or get an MBA and take over the family business. Engineers were the people who worked for him. The brightest young minds, at least those of white Anglo-Saxon stock in the United States, went to law school, business school, or medical school. But today, engineering schools are much harder to get into, but that was not true when I was going to college. Yes, my father was profoundly disappointed in me when I double majored in computer science and what Yale called engineering and applied science. I made it worse when I went to MIT for graduate school in engineering and then went to work as an engineer at Bell Labs, and worse still when I went to Berkeley for a PhD and then became a professor. This book is perhaps my last-ditch attempt to justify those decisions. When I started writing the book, I really didn't know who my target audience would be. As it has turned out, this book is targeted toward listeners who are either literate technologists or numerate humanists. I'm not sure how many such people there are, but I'm convinced there must be a few. I hope you are one of them. This book is my attempt to explain why the process of creating technology, a process that we call engineering, is a deeply creative process, and how this explains why it has become so hot and competitive, making geeks out of the brightest young minds. The book is about the culture of technology, about both its power and its limitations, and about how the real power of technology stems from its partnership with humans. I like to think of the book as a popular philosophy of technology, but I doubt it will be very popular, and I am not sure that I have the qualifications to write about philosophy. So really, the only guarantee I can make is that it is about technology and the engineers who create technology. And even then, it is limited to the part of technology that I understand best, specifically, the digital and information technology revolutions. This book is not about the artistry and creativity that is unleashed by using technology as a medium. For that topic, I recommend the wonderful book by Virginia Heffernan, Magic and Loss, Heffernan 2016. Heffernan claims that the Internet is a massive and collaborative work of realist art, but she is referring to the content of the Internet. In my book, I claim that Internet technology itself, and all of digital technology that shores it up, is a massive and collaborative creative work, even if not an artistic work. Digital technology as a medium for this latter sort of creativity has enormous potential, well beyond what has been accomplished to date. In the first part of this book, I explain exactly why this technology has been so transformative and liberating. I study how engineers use models and abstractions to build inventive artificial worlds and give us incredible capabilities, such as the ability to carry around in our pockets everything humans have ever published. But this is not to say that digital technology has no limitations. Pursuing a yin and yang balance in the second part of the book, I attempt to counter a runaway enthusiasm among some thought leaders about digital technology and computation. Driven by the immense potential of computers, this enthusiasm has led to unjustified beliefs that go as far as to assert that everything in the physical world is in fact a computation, in exactly the same sense as in modern computers. Everything, including such complex phenomena as human cognition and such unfamiliar objects as quasars, is software operating on digital data. I will argue that the evidence for such conclusions is weak, and the likelihood is remote that nature has limited itself to only processes that conform with today's notion of digital computation, and I will show that this digital hypothesis cannot be tested empirically and therefore can never be construed as a scientific theory. Because the likelihood is remote, the evidence is weak, and the hypothesis is untestable, these conclusions are an act of faith. My argument here will likely get me into trouble because I'm swimming against a considerable current. Also bucking much current thought, I argue that the goal of artificial intelligence to reproduce human cognitive functions in computers is misguided, is unlikely to succeed, and vastly underestimates the potential of computers. Instead, Technology is co-evolving with humans, augmenting our own cognitive and physical capabilities, all the while enabling us to nurture, evolve, and propagate the technology. We are seeing the emergence of symbiotic co-evolution, where the complementarity between humans and machines dominates over their competition. But most of the book is very much swimming with the current, upbeat about the enormous potential of technology to improve our lives. But more than just utilitarian, one of my main messages is that engineering is a deeply creative and intellectual discipline, every bit as interesting and rewarding as the arts and sciences. In areas where the technology is less mature, the creative contributions reflect the personalities, aesthetics, and idiosyncrasies of the creators. In areas that are more mature, the work can become deeply technical and opaque to outsiders. This happens in all disciplines, so this is hardly surprising. Like the sciences, engineering is built around accepted paradigms that provide frameworks for thought. Also like the sciences, engineering is punctuated by paradigm shifts, to use the words of Thomas Kuhn, Kuhn 1962. Unlike the sciences, however, the paradigm shifts are frequent, even relentless. I argue, in fact, that the pace of technological progress in our current culture is more limited by our human inability to assimilate new paradigms than by any physical limitations of the technology. I attempt in this book to explain why this is. Like the arts, the evolution of the field of engineering is governed by culture, language, and cross-germination of ideas. Also like the arts, success or failure is often determined by intangible and inexplicable forces such as fashion and culture. And in an observation that may take many listeners by surprise, also like the arts, the creative media used to engineer new artifacts and systems today, particularly digital media, have become astonishingly versatile and expressive. In my opinion, this latter property, the versatility and expressiveness of digital media, accounts for the attractiveness of the field to bright young minds, more even than the lucrative job prospects. Engineering is a broad field, encompassing everything from water supply systems to social networking software. Any individual, myself included, cannot have more than a superficial understanding of more than a few of its sub-disciplines. My arguments in this book, therefore, are based on my experience with electronics, electrical engineering, and computer science. These arguments apply to digital and information technologies, and may or may not apply to other technologies, such as bridges and chemical plants. Nevertheless, I do know from experience that digital technologies have invaded nearly all other engineering disciplines. Modern chemical plants, for example, include substantial computer control and therefore become instances of cyber-physical systems discussed in Chapter 6. Such systems are most certainly subject to the potential, vagaries, and limitations of digital technology that I point out in this book. I do not assume of the listener any particular technical background. In some sections of the book, I do dive more deeply than I probably should into technical topics that are near and dear to my heart, but I promise the listener that every such indulgence is short, and hopefully skipping the technical details will not seriously undermine the message. Please persist. The nerd storm will pass quickly. I do assume a numerate listener. Against all advice, I have even included 12 equations in the book. They are not complicated equations. High school math and science is more than sufficient to fully understand them, but even then, full understanding is not needed to get the message. My publisher has used this argument against me, saying that if it is true, I should remove them, but I like them. I have confidence that there are more numerate listeners than there used to be. I have assured the publisher that, counting my friends and family, a few dozen book sales are assured. The title of this book comes from the wonderful book by Nassim Nicholas Taleb, The Black Swan, Taleb 2010, who titled a section of the prologue, Plato and the Nerd. Taleb talks about Platonicity as the desire to cut reality into crisp shapes. Taleb laments the ensuing specialization and points out that such specialization blinds us to extraordinary events, which he calls black swans. Following Taleb, a theme of my book is that technical disciplines are also vulnerable to excessive specialization. Each specialty unwittingly adopts paradigms that turn the specialty into a slow-moving culture that resists rather than promotes innovation. But more fundamentally, the title puts into opposition the notion that knowledge, and hence technology, consists of Platonic ideals that exist independent of humans and is discovered by humans, and an opposing notion that humans create rather than discover knowledge and technology. The nerd in the title is a creative force, subjective and even quirky, and not an objective miner of pre-existing truths. I hope that through this book, I can change the public discourse so young people are more inclined to consider a career in engineering, and not just because of the job prospects. I'm convinced that engineering is fundamentally a creative discipline, and the technical drudgery that prejudices many people is no more drudgery than found in any other creative discipline. Yes, hard work is required, but as a reward for that hard work, you can change the world. Overview of the chapters. Some listeners like to be told what they will be told before they are told it. Putting aside the problematic self-referentiality, for those listeners, I provide here a brief overview of the book. But honestly, I recommend skipping this and going directly to Chapter 1. The story told in this book cannot be accurately summarized in a few paragraphs, and any such summary will necessarily make the book seem more dense than it is. Nevertheless, for those who really need it, here is my summary. Popular perception of technology and engineering is often one of a dispassionate field dominated by logic and trading in colorless facts and truths. In Chapter 1, I explore the idea of facts and truths in technology, showing that these are not just discovered, but more often invented or designed. Rather than being built on timeless Platonic ideals, technology is built on ideas that are more fluid and sometimes quirky. The notion of truth becomes more subjective, collective wisdom becomes better than individual wisdom, a narrative about how facts evolve becomes more interesting than the facts themselves. Facts and truths may be wrong, and it can cost billions to show that facts are true. I then develop the idea that engineering and science, disciplines rooted in facts and truths, are complementary and overlapping, leveraging each other's methodologies. In this chapter, I try to understand the cultural phenomenon that engineering has been considered the kid sister of science. In Chapter 2, I focus on the relationship between discovery and invention. A key theme of this chapter is that models are invented, not discovered, and it is the usefulness of models, not their truth, that gives them value. Note that the usefulness of a model need not be a practical, utilitarian sort of usefulness. A model may be useful simply because it explains or predicts observations, even if the phenomena observed have no practical application. Models are useful to scientists when they are faithful to the natural system being studied, whereas models are useful to engineers when a physical realization can be constructed that is faithful to the model. These uses are complementary and, in fact, are often applied in combination. Chapter 2 is heavily influenced by Kuhn, 1962, but Kuhn focused on science, not engineering. The engineering use of models results in more room for creativity in the construction of models, because it is not necessary for the models to be faithful to some pre-existing natural system, but the use of models can also slow technological change, because models are built on paradigms that frame our thinking and therefore limit our thinking. Models can also get quite sophisticated, forcing increased specialization, which can also slow change by impeding communication across specializations. In Chapter 3, I dive into exactly how the engineering use of models enables creativity. I do this by illustrating the role that models have played in the development of digital technology, where models are stacked many layers deep, with the design of each layer affecting the designs both above and below it. Digital technology has, through the multiplicity of layers, mostly removed any meaningful physical constraints from a broad class of engineered systems. Each layer of models conforms with an established paradigm, a way of modeling and abstracting an engineered design. Innovation, therefore, is less limited by the physics of the technology than by our imagination and ability to assimilate new paradigms. I argue that paradigms play a central role in digital technology, because without them, no human could possibly comprehend the complexity of the systems we routinely build today. But these paradigms are human constructions, governed by culture and language. In many cases, the paradigms that have emerged are idiosyncratic, reflecting the personality and aesthetics of their creators. A notable feature of digital technology is that paradigms are layered one on top of another. Semiconductor physics gives us the ability to make transistors, which we can use as electrically controlled switches, that have two distinct states, on and off. This enables a digital abstraction that turns out to be just the first of many layers, building up eventually to the programming languages that enable us to build databases, machine learning systems, web servers, and so on. Each of these layers forms through coalescing of competing paradigms. In Chapter 4, I explore the layered paradigms that make up much of today's digital technology hardware. I show that the physical substance of the hardware is not durable, but the paradigms are. The hardware is routinely discarded every few years as it wears out and becomes obsolete, but the principles on which the hardware is designed, with all their warts and idiosyncrasies, persist for decades. In Chapter 5, I explore the layered paradigms that make up much of today's information technology. These paradigms define how we construct software, and software, it turns out, endures much better than hardware. Paradigms, like human culture, change slowly, particularly compared with the speed with which technology changes. Although Kuhn's scientific paradigms are strictly human constructions, the paradigms of software are encoded in the software. In an orgy of self-referentiality, software builds its own scaffolding. The self-scaffolding of software makes it much more durable than hardware, despite its ephemeral, non-substantive existence. It could even outlast humans. Chapter 6 explores the structure of technology revolutions, with a particular focus on digital technology. This chapter is also heavily influenced by Kuhn, but it strives to identify how technology revolutions differ from scientific revolutions. One key difference is that technology paradigms appear and disappear much more rapidly, probably because compared with scientific paradigms, they are relatively unconstrained by the physical world and are layered one upon another many layers deep. Like scientific paradigms, new technology paradigms do not necessarily replace old ones. They may instead overlay the old ones, building new platforms on top of existing platforms. The ability to do this depends on the transitivity of models explored in the three previous chapters. Unlike scientific paradigms, the crises that trigger new technology paradigms do not arise so much from the discovery of anomalies, but from increasing complexity and technology-driven opportunity. To balance the enthusiasm, the next few chapters look at what we cannot do with digital technology, at least not today. This requires explaining three classic concepts that emerged in the 20th century: Shannon's information theory, the Church-Turing thesis, and Gödel's incompleteness of formal models. In the later chapters, I consider the concept of determinism and examine how we can build models that embrace uncertainty using the notion of probability. Along the way, I need to confront another paradigm that emerged in 20th century called digital physics and a view that human cognition is software. This part of the story begins in Chapter 7, where I examine the concept of information, what it is, and how to measure it. In this chapter, I introduce Claude Shannon's way of measuring information and show that his notion of information often cannot be represented digitally. I define an information processing machine more broadly than what can be realized using software and computers as they exist today. In Chapter 8, I explain what software cannot do. I point out that the number of information processing functions is vastly larger than the number of possible computer programs. I introduce Alan Turing's undecidability result, which shows that useful information processing functions exist that are not realizable by software on today's computers. But it does not follow that if a function is not realizable by software, then it is not realizable by any machine. I caution against getting carried away by enthusiasm, marveling at what has already been accomplished with software, and caution against predicting that natural phenomena such as cognition and understanding are realizable in software. Here I am forced to confront a belief that some people call digital physics, that the physical world is somehow software or equivalent to software. I argue that this idea is unlikely to be either true or useful as a way of understanding the physical world, at least in its more extreme forms, and I show that this thesis is not falsifiable and therefore not scientific. In Chapter 9, I go beyond the countable world of computing and argue that computers are not universal machines and their real power comes from their partnership with humans. I explain the notion of a continuum, a concept that is out of reach for software and rejected by digital physics, but seemingly essential for modeling the physical world. I examine the fundamental limitations of formal models that underlie the world of software, and I argue that the partnership and co-evolution of humans and computers is much more powerful than either alone. In this chapter, I explain Kurt Gödel's famous incompleteness theorems, which impose fundamental limits on any modeling formalism that is capable of self-reference. We need to be humble, but we also need to recognize the as-yet vast unexplored potential that still waits for us to catch up. In Chapter 10, I consider determinism, a property of software and many mathematical models of nature. I argue that determinism is a property of models not of the physical world, but it is an extremely valuable property, one that has historically delivered considerable payoffs in engineering and science. However, determinism also has its limits. Even deterministic models may not be usefully predictive because of chaos and complexity. Also, families of deterministic models that embrace both discrete and continuous behaviors are incomplete. There are unavoidable holes where determinism breaks down, and deterministic models have their limitations. In many cases, non-deterministic models are simpler and better reflect what we do not know. Non-deterministic models, used explicitly and judiciously, play an essential role in engineering. In Chapter 11, I finally confront the meaning of randomness and its measure, probability, which quantifies the likelihood of non-deterministic events. I argue that probability is fundamentally a model of uncertainty about something and not directly a model of that something. It models what we do not know. I examine the long-standing debate between the frequentists and the Bayesians, coming down solidly on the side of the Bayesians. I show that the philosophical difficulties presented by randomness vanish when using models in the engineering sense rather than the scientific sense, and when interpreting probability in the Bayesian sense. In this chapter, I also reconsider continuums and argue that probabilistic models over continuums reinforce the conclusion that digital physics is extremely unlikely. As a consequence, we should demand incontrovertible evidence for digital physics before accepting it. In the final chapter, I tie things together by examining the epistemic role that models have in technology and the relationship between models and the physical systems they ultimately model. I leverage the previous arguments in the book. At least with digital technology, so many layers of abstraction exist between the models and the physical reality that the connection between the two becomes tenuous indeed. Moreover, the self-scaffolding that software paradigms have, described in Chapter 5, allows these models to stand on their own, almost but not completely independent of physical reality. I argue that this does not lead to a Cartesian mind-body dualism, but it does emphasize the need to insist, with great determination and discipline, on separating the map from the territory. Models are best viewed as having a separate reality from the physical world, despite existing in the physical world. The most expressive modeling paradigms are capable of self-reference, which enables them to build their own scaffolding, but also makes them necessarily incomplete. This incompleteness is fundamentally what enables creativity and ensures that what we can accomplish with technology is limitless. So what holds us back? In this final chapter, I consider both the obstacles to progress and the threats that technology, when misapplied, can have on society. 1. Yang. 1. Shadows on the Wall. In which I examine the very idea of facts and truths, showing that collective wisdom about them can be better than individual wisdom, a narrative about facts can be more interesting than the facts themselves, facts and truths may be invented or even designed, not just discovered, facts and truths may be wrong, and it can cost billions to show that facts are true, and oh yes, nerds are misunderstood, and science and engineering get confused. 1.1. Nerds. I am a nerd. According to the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, a nerd is an unstylish, unattractive, or socially inept person, especially one slavishly devoted to intellectual or academic pursuits, a person who is very interested in technical subjects, computers, etc. Who but a nerd would start a book with a quote from the dictionary? I wouldn't expect a nerd to write very well, particularly not for a general audience. Actually, I'm quite sure this book would be much better if it were written by someone else. But I can't get anyone else to write it, so I will compensate by quoting the writing of others, even from dictionaries. The previous definition was presumably written by a trustworthy expert on the subject of nerdiness. We expect that the publishers of dictionaries go to some effort to ensure that the definitions are written by experts. In contrast, we cannot assume that a Wikipedia page about nerds would be written by experts. Anyone with internet access can modify the contents of a Wikipedia page. There is no vetting of expertise. Nevertheless, the page for nerd largely concurs with Merriam-Webster but offers more. Though originally derogatory, nerd is a stereotypical term, but as with other pejoratives, it has been reclaimed and redefined by some as a term of pride and group identity. Now I am reassured that I can be proud to be a nerd. Continuing with an etymology, the first documented appearance of the word nerd is as the name of a creature in Dr. Seuss's book If I Ran the Zoo, 1950, in which the narrator Gerald McGrew claims that he would collect a nurkle, a nerd, and a seersucker, too, for his imaginary zoo. Citations to Merriam-Webster in the American Heritage Dictionary. The slang meaning of the term dates to the next year, 1951, when Newsweek magazine reported on its popular use as a synonym for drip or square in Detroit, Michigan. At some point, the word took on connotations of bookishness and social ineptitude. I like this narrative better than the dictionary definition because it focuses on how the word came about and how it evolved rather than what it is. Most facts are more interesting when we understand how they came to be facts rather than just accepting them as if they were always there. But is this Wikipedia article authoritative? The article points out that American satirist Weird Al Yankovic's song White and Nerdy states that editing Wikipedia is a stereotypical nerd interest. I am therefore reassured that this article is likely written by experts on nerdiness. There's a big difference in style between a dictionary definition and a narrative about culture. A dictionary definition is usually understood to give a fact, a truth. Merriam-Webster defines definition as an explanation of the meaning of a word, phrase, etc. This definition gives definitions the aura of facts and truths, de-emphasizing their instability and fluidity with human culture. Most of us approach technology as if it too were a compendium of facts and truths. We assume that technology advances because people discover more facts and truths. Because the discovery of facts and truths is the realm of science, science therefore drives technology. But I doubt that the technology of Wikipedia came about as a consequence of the discovery of facts and truths. Wikipedia is a software system created by Jimmy Wales and Larry Sanger, who put the first version online in 2001. I don't know them, but one of my prejudices is that many software people are nerds, so there is a reasonable chance they too are nerds. According to the Wikipedia article on Wikipedia, Sanger coined its name as a portmanteau of wiki and encyclopedia. Following the link to the page on wiki, we learn that a wiki is a website that allows collaborative modification of its content and structure differently from the web browser. That page tells us that wiki is a Hawaiian word meaning quick and credits Ward Cunningham with inventing the wiki. I hope you will agree that it would be odd to say that Cunningham discovered the wiki, so presumably this was not an advance creditable to science, but the nuanced relationship between discovery and invention and between science and engineering is not always so clear. Cunningham's 2001 book with Beau Luff describes the wiki concept as follows. A wiki invites all users to edit any page or to create new pages within the wiki website using only a plain vanilla web browser without any extra add-ons. Wiki promotes meaningful topic associations between different pages by making page link creation almost intuitively easy and showing whether an intended target page exists or not. A wiki is not a carefully crafted site for casual visitors. Instead, it seeks to involve the visitor in an ongoing process of creation and collaboration that constantly changes the website landscape. Luff and Cunningham, 2001. I love that web browsers come in plain vanilla flavors. I wonder what other flavors are available. This description starts to give us the sense that a wiki, and particularly Wikipedia, is as much a cultural artifact as a technological one, and as with all cultural artifacts, it didn't suddenly pop into existence at the instant of invention. In fact, inventions almost never do, and nearly always have a strongly cultural element. The meaningful topic associations between different pages.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?